your creative voice is actually primarily, it's a language to talk to yourself with. It's to find out who you are, who you become, what it looks like when you do.
Hello, I'm Renee Von Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%'s podcast. We explore roles and opportunities within the creative industries with the aim of improving diversity, in addition to promoting, providing a platform, and shouting about awesome women and those identifying as non-binary. Episode 85, I'm joined by occupational therapist, artist, and one-third of electro-punk band, charismatic megafauna, Georgia Twigg. Georgia studied fine art at Chelsea University of the Arts, specialising in sculptural installation. Developing their practice post-graduating led them to making music and forming the band with Susanna Wirth and Jenny Moore in 2013. The meaning of the band's name, charismatic megafauna, references to large animal species with symbolic value or widespread popular appeal. If you haven't heard their music, straight after listening to this episode, I suggest you find them on Bandcamp or YouTube and turn up the volume really loud. Political, energizing, smart with wink wink lyrics, for me personally, the sound, energy, and visceral response I have to listening to songs such as Sorry and Guys in Spandex is as if Carolee Sneham, Kate Bush, and Sleater Kinney birthed the most thoroughly beautiful charismatic megafauna. The band has toured across the UK as well as performing in Norway, Holland, and Greece, and released their debut album, Semi-Regular, in 2016. Georgia, whilst working for a number of years as a teaching and therapy assistant, decided to do a postgraduate degree in occupational therapy, and now works within the health and social care sector. Combining their skills as an artist with their knowledge of physical and mental well-being, they have led a number of workshops focusing on staying positive and engaged in the face of disagreement. Commissioned by Keep It Complex as part of the Jerwood and Film Video Umbrella Awards 2019, Georgia facilitated sessions on how to talk to people you disagree with, which is now available as a podcast and accompanied by a zine. It is super practical and gives you a lot of really useful information on managing your own health and well-being in confronting situations, such as campaigning or protesting. Details of how to access the podcast and zine will be included in the show notes. I've known Georgia for over a decade, but it must have been at least 3 years since we saw each other. So I'm super excited to hear what they've been up to. Georgia, welcome to Greater Than 11%.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So let's dive in, because a bit like me, you kind of cover multiple sectors and have very like diverse strands to what you do in your career or careers. So as I mentioned, you're an occupational therapist. You make up one third of the band, Charismatic Megafauna, and you're also an artist. So most creative people, you know, are juggling multiple roles to basically pay the bills, to be creative. So I'm wondering if you can give us an overview of those roles and what they include and how they cross over.
I'll start with the one that feels the most uncomfortable for me. And I think that is to give myself the title of artist, because that's been the biggest personal struggle for me and been the thing that has most commonly sort of, it flares up and then it falls by the wayside depending on what I'm doing. The most consistent has been the band for 7 years. It's been, you know, steadily growing. We have an album now. We toured Europe last year. And then my work as an occupational therapist has, it's been a ride the last 4 years in the NHS. And that's about to become part-time university lecturer in occupational therapy. So that's about to be really transformative. I should probably say as well, balancing these things, I find it very frying. There's like, I'm not going to pretend in any way that there's any elegance to it or like particularly good organizational skills. In fact, they're terrible. So, I mean, I think for me, this thing that often gets pushed forward. So my first degree was in arts and that was always sort of in a way. So that gave that a spot in the foreground. And then it was through needing money to work, but trying to find something meaningful, that I went into working in education and I found about occupational therapy. and then became an occupational therapist. And that's, the non-art job is often seen as like the money job. But for me, I think it's very much the inspiration for all the creativity for me. Working with people, working deep in society and parts of society that I wouldn't normally go into simply because we don't operate like that. We don't, as a society, we think we're all together, but we're not. We're in slipstreams running concurrently. You know, it looks like the ocean all mixed in, but actually the specific currents and things aren't crossing over as easily as it might look. It's not as blended as it seems. So for me, my work in education and health has been like a real privilege to have experiences with people that I wouldn't otherwise have. I think this next step into teaching part-time feels like incredibly exciting because I get to be more reflective. As part of my role is much more about developing myself in a way that feels creative and feels closer to the artistic practice and the collaborative working that I'm doing in other parts of my life. And I was saying to somebody the other day, like it can feel very fractured and difficult at times to switch from very different mindsets. And especially the way the NHS works, I've been trying to do that full time alongside having a full life that's meaningful to me. And I think the NHS doesn't allow that. So I'm having these really frantic days, but I'm an occupational therapist and I should explain what that means, which is ultimately using occupation to enhance a person's well-being and quality of life, if that's physical or if that's mental, whatever form that takes. And the ultimate goal is always self-actualization or realizing self and knowing that that's a constantly renewing process. That doesn't, you don't get there and you're done. That's the life journey. And so it's felt really important to be living that theory out for myself in terms of what I make and what I do, and in terms of surrounding myself with things that are life-giving and give me the energy to do the more mundane things in life. I don't know if this is that sounding like it makes sense?
It's making total sense. And I've also had that whole, it feels very fractured. You know, I've got all these strands. They're kind of somehow interlinked, but one sometimes takes precedent over the other. And it can be, like you're saying, it can be really tiring.
Yeah. I think there's like this constant shifting of priorities. Like you're between, you can be between three or four different worlds at any one time, especially if you're doing like workshops and along, like I've done like a lecture at UAL or I do a workshop over here or there. You know, I think it's been something like maybe 6 years in total I've been doing that How to Talk to People You Don't Agree With workshop in different forms and in different places and in very different settings. And so you can be like, you know, have this workshop here and that workshop there, but then you're doing your job, but then, you know, your day job, there's five different strands you're managing, and then you want to think creatively, but how do you get in that space? In terms of priority, that's the thing where I feel really like I can feel really pulled around, because at work, you know, the consultant psychiatrist and your team manager, that's the priority, and everybody in that environment, their career in health is their focus. And then you come to your band or whatever collaboration you're in, and you need to be present in that space, and there's a huge amount that has to be done there, and you need to work out like, well, what, how can I try and be myself mostly here? But again, it's a shared space with mixed priorities and mixed needs and mixed amounts that can be contributed. Yeah, I would reflect that for me, and this is something I've really thought about, that's why personal work has like really dwindled to a degree. I did a week in Cardiff on a residency and just spent the time there daydreaming about the things I would like to do. And then lockdown occurred, you know, 6 months, 5 months after that. And only now am I starting to find small ways to do that. And I'm having to think of that in a much more flow-based way. That's the only way I'm feeling able to access it again. Like it has to be a space of play, because if everything else is a space of focus and commitment, then this commitment has to feel different. Like that's the place for me where the flexibility and movement has to be. And I do think that says a lot as well. Maybe about, you know, a person socialized as female, the place where I give up space is when it's just for me. And that, but that's my decision. Not everybody is doing it that way, obviously. But I've thought, I kind of used occupational therapy theory for myself, said, okay, I'm missing flow. I'm missing absolute freedom. I'm missing lack of pressure and just reconnecting to creative voice. And that's the space I can do it. So I've just been doing very simple things in that side of things at the moment, but I'm really just hopeful and excited about the idea of being on 3 days a week in a learning environment. I'm almost like hysterical with it. When I got the job, I was just like, so I'm kind of not even letting myself, because I don't start for another few weeks, kind of just being like, until it definitely happens, because it feels too good to be true to have that space.
I think as creative people and as creative makers as well, there's only so much headspace.
Mm.
Like, you can be the most organized person in the world and you can still only have that much creative energy. Like, I don't think it's infinite. I think I, in the past, used to really beat myself up that I wasn't working hard enough or long enough, despite, you know, I'm someone that's got a lot of drive and a lot and can work long hours, but never feeling like it was enough. And I think there's something in that, that, you know, when you are juggling and surviving and paying the bills and you're part of many things, which is awesome. It's such a great space to occupy, to have loads of different things and you know, feel stimulated in different ways. You can't always make.
Yeah.
And it ebbs and flows, you know. I think I've gotten a lot more comfortable with that rather than beat myself up, which I used to do.
Yeah, I think that takes time as well, doesn't it? Just to live through life and be like, that was impossible. Like, why would I have thought it was? And yeah, the blame around like productivity and not understanding that we are a finite resource. I think this is things that over lockdown as well, there's been a lot more conversations around like capitalist models of how to exist. And like, it's just not possible. Creativity is used constantly in loads of forms. So you're using it up, doing something that isn't like creative, but you are using up your resource in that space. Just even being creative about like, where am I going to find a room to book my flipping meeting? And it's like, right, well, maybe we'll go there or there. And it's like, it's just these little things that wear away, but don't give back enough to kind of replenish the source, which I think is why finding space for play is so important.
I've never asked you this, and I put this in the questions to you because I do remember the first time I saw you and I felt like an absolute stalker. Was you... because I knew of you through Joe, our mutual friend, and he had said that you were studying, and I don't know, maybe I saw you at a party or something, but then I saw you posing in your degree showpiece, which is a field of wheat within the Chelsea Art School. But I believe that you super glued all the wheat to the floor, the stalks of wheat, is that right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Wheat and lavender to the floor to make the field,
And so it smelled like delicious, but you were also like posing quite hilariously, and your parents were taking pictures of you. And I was like, oh, I know them and this is happening. And yeah, it was such a weird moment. So I'd love to know why you decided to study art and what led up to that and kind of, you know, what that career or where you kind of stepped off once you graduated.
Yeah. So gosh, why did I study art? I mean, you know, going through school, I was of a generation that was going to university and it was just a matter of picking it. I mean, I started my degree at St. Martin's, and I think since I was 11, I had been following fashion designers in Star magazine, like Alexander McQueen and Tom Ford. That was like my football. I was like, oh my God. And I remember like Tom Ford's first collection for Gucci coming out and people being like, oh my God, all these beaded shoes. So it's really engraved in there. And I read in the Sunday Times style supplement from early on, you know, they'd all graduated from St. Martin's. And I'd been, you know, told, you get told from a young age, don't you? Like, you're good at art. Yeah, so I was just muddling along, doing what I enjoyed. I have to be honest, I'm someone who didn't study, but did quite well anyway. My habit, and it's still to this day, is to be very instant and to kind of just walk in and see what happens and use my emotions to be my guide, my intuition. Like, I'm very sort of emotion-led and then critique shortly afterwards. And I think just going through the education system, it became clear that knuckling down wasn't going to be my thing, but art was going well. It was like feeling more and more free. And then it really kicked off when we had a project where we had to copy an artist. And I, you know, you just get told basically copy an artist. I don't know why that's an art project. I chose Francis Bacon, and then something really clicked about being gestural. And I started to think a lot more philosophically about it. So I did the foundation, you know, see what happens. But in my head, I was always going to apply to St. Martin's because I always had been. But then I just couldn't get on with fashion, or I felt too daunted by fashion, or I felt like part of me still wishes I'd just done fashion. But instead I went for sculpture because I've always loved it. And I basically was going with what I love and what I feel intuitive about. I like making objects. I like creating a scene. I wasn't sure. I was kind of caught between theatre because I was doing a lot of theatre at the time as well. And I have since made like set and costume for a children's theatre show, which was great. And kind of just wound up there in a way. I just followed what I enjoyed up to that point. I got to St. Martin's and I didn't like it. I did not like it. There was nothing gentle at the time there. I didn't really understand what's, and I understand now. I look back and in my mental health roles, I work with people with ADHD all the time, and everything that they're going through is like, I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly how I see the world. So I see that I struggled with structure, I struggled with anxiety, I struggled with not being quite sure how to, I just wasn't ready. You know, if I could go back in time, I'd probably take like 3 years off and start again. Yeah, so I wound up there. Then Chelsea looked a bit warmer and cozier because a lot of the people I was in halls with were either, they're all on, mostly on different courses. And so I transferred to Chelsea, where it did feel a bit warmer and cozier, and was just thinking about temporality of work. The field of wheat was the idea, like the work slowly destroyed. And like this kind of this sort of this folk memory we all have of walking through a field of wheat given to us by TV and film. But very few of us have. I never have. Theresa May has, of course. This idea of actually building that scenario so people do have the memory of it, but also it's destroyed so that all there is the work is the memory of it. Yeah, and I think the people that I got on with there also had quite lyrical, gentle, playful work as well. But I do really think back looking at that time. That was the time when people were making fun of people who made paintings, you know? And I think, oh, it's very different now. Like if you were making big voluptuous ceramics, then people would be like, why are you doing that? We're all making big machines that bang. And yeah, that's 2006 for reference. But yeah, from there, I did that show again in Stroud in an exhibition of graduates straight after, really. I was still in the same house at university. So I did that in like the September. And I think, where did things go from that? After that, I went to Berlin for a while, messed about, had a lovely time, came to terms with myself. And I think really it took a while of kind of just living in the world, basically doing what I should have done before the degree, which is just existing in the world and seeing what that felt like, you know, making a living, keeping myself alive, getting a sense of what the world's like, having a much better time than I did when I was in university, because I had not enjoyed that first and second year, really. It kind of come together a bit in the third, doing all the things that sort of, yeah, basically remaking the experiences I would have wanted it before, starting to come back towards making things. So that was when I started just doing some more low-key stuff for myself in my room, but then making this theatre set was a big step. So making this large set that toured for a play, making all the costume for that. And that sort of sparked things off again. And then as that was sort of around that time of bits and pieces of having a studio, when we're in the same studio building, I think the band formed around then. And then at the same time as the band forming is around the time, just shortly after that, is when I started my postgraduate qualification in occupational therapy. So, and that was around all around my Saturn return, or just before, sort of starting around just maybe a couple of years before the old Saturn return, which is that 28 to 32 year old period of time was just my whole life changed then. And I think it's really from there that just been such a lot of changes and a lot happened in terms of, yeah, using the band as a space to be really visible and be really thoughtful. And I know that we all three of us do this. We're being viewed now. What do we look like? What do we want to very mindfully think about how we're seen? And for me, that was very much about disregarding the gaze. So the societal gaze, which is most so predominantly informed by the male gaze, and deciding that I didn't want to wear any makeup. I wanted to basically be in pajamas. I wanted to wear things that would seem intentionally frumpy or badly organized or something. Like sometimes it's a bit of a punk thing, but a lot of the time it's just a mess. And that's what I want. That's what I want to feel like, what it feels like. I want to know what it feels like to be seen in this exposed way that I've chosen. And it felt incredibly liberating as I eased into that further and further, to the point that I think it led to realizing I don't care about the male gaze at all, and never really have. Very much shifting my attention completely to another place in all aspects of my life. So yeah, I would say the band helped me to come out, yeah.
So speaking of the band, because, you know, it definitely has, and I referenced that in the intro, it has a performative performance art bent to it for sure. And I would say a very strong bend.
Yeah.
It is, the videos are so pleasurable to watch because one, whilst you say they might look disorganized and frumpy and whatever, they're highly organized in another way, because they're ways of thinking about pushing against the system without overthinking it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And also, like, you guys have so much fun when you do it. I can't remember which song it is, but when you're in the back of the van and you're doing
I think that's Hole.
Yes, it is Hole, that's right.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be part of that. I think there's something in that energy, like it has a bit of that Riot Girl energy, like it's for you and it's for you guys and you're exploring that space for you. And not in a weird jealousy, like, oh, I wish I was in a band or whatever. It's a case of, like, I want some of that.
Yeah.
It feels right.
We sat down and talked about what was important to us, because we came to it as, we weren't musicians looking for a place to enjoy playing. We were people who had some things that we wanted to say, or we wanted to see something in the world, and we thought, right, well, let's push ourselves to have a go at it. So we formed, and I think this is crucial, a festival called Supernormal, which is a great music and art festival. But on that day, there was a women's hour on these hay bales up on a field, and it's quite a small festival, so the main stage is down there. And people are talking about, like, wasn't Riot Girl good? And somebody like, what did they say? They said Riot Girl was good. It's like, oh yeah. Because we couldn't hear, because we were drowned out by these guys in bands playing drone music. And I think that day there was almost no women on any stage, no women or AFAB people. And I think the next day there were some, but I think that day we looked and we couldn't see any, and definitely none headline, like, fronted by. And we're just like, God, that does sum it up, doesn't it? So then we had a thought, we were like, well, we should make a band and it should just be a really, really loud one. A bit later, we met up for like a first rehearsal, and we were talking about, well, what do we want to do? Skip to the end of that conversation, we all wanted to play drums. And so we facilitated, what we made for each other is the opportunity for all of us to play drums. We gave each other all the opportunity we wanted to make a lot of noise, have a really free space, and not sort of go by norms of, like, well, you have a guitar or you have a this or have a that. It's like, no, you just got to have a go at being what you want to be in this organize. That's entirely what this is for. It's much more to do that than it is to make the music, which feels very punk to me. And none of us had played the drums before, so we started with this philosophy of public learning, which is, we're just going to do our learning in front of everybody, and we might get better, we don't know, because we're trying it out right now. And I think that vulnerability, I think it does come through, because, like, I'm really passionate about karaoke, and what I love about it is the struggle. I don't want to hear a song sung perfectly. I want to see somebody go for it with the passion that they have for that song. And for me, I know that I bring that energy to the band as well, of like, this is about thrashing this out. And if it's not for me, if it's not on the edge of challenge, it sort of loses something a bit. Like, once it gets too easy, it's like, right, well, so we need something new. We need to keep learning publicly. And we also talked about things that were important to us to be, like, core. So we had quite, like, a methodology to it. Like, generosity is really important. So this thing of, like, generosity or hospitality, of feeling welcoming, of feeling like we want it to be a good space. We think about what invites we accept or where we go. We think about, if we say yes to this, what does this mean to other bands? Like, if we accept another unpaid gig somewhere, does that just perpetuate a load of people just still not getting paid anything? Or if we say, look, we would need these costs covered, does that then, you know, can that contribute to the conversation around, like, how do you pay bands? Because we're producing something, it's not to claw in big bucks, it's just to say, like, you know, people are making something, and the people who are starting out you know, they may, that might be the thing that stops them from continuing. So yeah, and it feels really heartening every time somebody says, oh yeah, yeah, I would want to get in on that. I want some of that energy. Cause it's like, great, come and like have some, like make a band, you know, ask us anything you like. If we can help, we'll probably just be like, woo, and just like cheer you on. And the amount of times we've heard somebody saying like, oh, do you want to be in a drum band with me, to their friend as they leave the gig, is like, that's the most desired outcome for sure.
I mean, I'm totally in admiration of your bravery, because, you know, like the whole shame and like, I don't know, failure kind of perspective has definitely been part of my journey, like trying to overcome that. So it's the fact that you're like, fuck it, I'm just going to go play
the drum. I will say, like, in the early days, I used to get this anxiety response where like half of my face would go a bit numb and I'd be like, oh. It's from this like breath holding, because I just thought at the beginning, for me, we've all had personal journeys with it, and I think that we have all got different motivators, or like the seed of what keeps us there, or like that we want to keep pushing it, and that can even change within each one of us as we go. But for me, at the very beginning, I was like, I feel really nervous about this, but it's something I want to be someone who does this, because this is what I want to do. So then I'm just going to have to do it. I'm just going to have to put myself up there. And I think the shame, what you said there, it really feels like a really good space to confront shame. And I think that's part of the me actively disregarding a gaze on me and being like, I mean, you know, played in my pants sometimes, just whatever feels like it's going to blast out that feeling of shame or fear of failure.
I mean, humor also plays in the band and the work. You are loud, you're visible, you like take the room with you, or even just the viewer if you're watching something, but we're also giggling. Like, can I say that? Because it's like, it's not laugh out loud, there's like a little, I don't know, and I kind of said that, there's like a wink wink, you know, like there's like, we're in on it, but yeah. We also appreciate, because like it's highly political as well.
I mean, we are all funny people, but for me personally, like everything is through the lens of humor or deep intense reflection. If I was going to go from a psychological viewpoint, you know, humor is bonding, and we need to be brought together. We need a space of being lifted up. And I think that joy is so important. If you're raging about something, we want to keep that energy upward. It's like, it's not enough just to get really angry. Like, what keeps us moving forward and what keeps us united in that space where we are acknowledging it, but we're acknowledging it together as a positive force rather than a serious space. I'm just like a big clown. I just like to make jokes, you know?
But I think as well in the lyrics, and also knowing you, like sarcasm can underline a point.
Yeah.
You can really take it to being something you're thinking about, to like, ooh, feeling it. And I think, you know, you are very good at that personally, but it's also, I can feel that in the music that the band are, you know, putting together.
And I think as well, we want something that really uplifts us. And it does go back to like our own experience of making the music and performing the music. Like, we want to have a good time. We want to have a party, you know, we want to get everyone revved up and hyped up and ready to dance and let off some steam and just have the best time possible. Yeah. And I think a little wink helps bring people with you.
Yeah, it's true. So let's talk about the workshops that you've been leading, how to talk to people you disagree with. And as I mentioned, one of those workshops is also available in podcast form, which I'll put in the show notes. But can you talk me through how that came about and what it covers in more detail?
How to affect positive change, or how to communicate effectively, and how to manage conflict has always been of interest to me. And during my study for my qualification, was just talking about that side of that sort of thing, because it's in the nature of my work to have to try and encourage and facilitate change of habit for well-being, and also can mean coming into contact with like quite conflict heavy situations if you're working in like a mental health setting or in a physical health setting, because they intersect, of course. And I just came across something that seemed really useful. And the base theory for it is called motivational interviewing, but it rides on this evidence that if you tell people something, they will not agree with it. But if you talk to people in a way where they talk about the change or the thing that could be different, you know, if you change that strategy, you have much better outcomes in terms of managing conflict, facilitating change. And I just thought, this has been written in a clinical context, but there's absolutely no reason why we can't take that out into the world generally to just have better conversations with each other. That was sort of mulling over. And then the Brexit referendum came up. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, this is absolutely tearing people apart. Like, people are falling out with people close to them. It's this split that isn't like a split we've had before. It's not left and right. It's, people said split the country in two. I don't think it did. I think it split people in four, because the left and the right were also divided. Like, Michael Heseltine is speaking on a platform that's pro the thing I'm there protesting for. It's like, what is going on? You know, it was a very strange time. Rosalie Schweiker, we keep it complex, putting together a conference around these themes. And I just said, oh, I would like to present something. Like, this is the idea I have in my head, and I'd like to present a workshop of this kind, just to see how that goes and how people respond to it. And Laura Gordon was also interested in that. She's a graphic artist and designer. And so she sort of did graphic facilitation and made these beautiful maps of the journey of the conversations that was happening. So yeah, the idea really was just to bring practical strategies to people who knew they wanted to engage in conversations, but wanted some tools to help them feel safe and to help them have a bit of a more stable base to come from when dealing with that sort of a situation. Yeah, and from there, that was Brexit originally, but then we did it around the election. I've done it, did it for Repeal the 8th, around speaking to your family about abortion or at Christmas time. Yeah, quite a few other settings. At Bound Art Book Fair last year in Norway as part of a series of workshops preparing for Borealis Festival. So it's like, it's been quite flexible, but it really focuses on, so in my profession, you have therapeutic use of self. It's where you are the therapeutic tool, the primary therapeutic tool, which is a lot of work, but at the same time, it also gives you a sense of a bit of an anchor. You know, you can decide who you're going to be, how you're going to come to a conversation and affect change and get to know yourself more, so you know when you need to opt out, you know your limitations, and you can develop compassion for yourself. And in doing so, develop compassion for those you might talk to. And then that just is about improving communication. I mean, there's lots of caveats to it. There's definitely times to step away from conflict, times when having an argument and a conflict is actually appropriate. And I think these last 6 months, is it seven now, even 6 or 7 months, have highlighted a whole set of new things to reflect, or a new light has been shed on more of the nuances of what we need to think about in all the different kinds of difficult conversations that can be had, because they are so varied. And it's not all just like door knocking for Brexit. The stakes are high. They're not getting higher, but the increased height of them is being revealed.
So your practice, and I know we talked about early on about, you know, you're still kind of not grappling, but working through what your art practice is, because you've got so many strands to what you're doing. And it definitely, a lot has come out in the band. And like I said, that is a lot more performance art, and even what you wear and how you perform feels like that. But the workshops, you know, the band, your practice feels really connected to DIY culture. So I'm wondering if you've considered how that fits in or plugs in to your role as an occupational therapist, if at all.
Well, I think I'm an occupational therapist because I'm a DIY sort of person. As an occupational therapist, you're always having to make something, you're always having to cobble together a session, you're constantly tweaking things around an individual, you're pulling together a group and facilitating something then and there. So it's very in the moment. And I think that's a lot of why I'm drawn to the profession. It's this combination of reflection on why you would do something, what the theory is behind it, what the philosophy is behind it, but then it's just getting in and physically making it happen. And I think that's the person that I am when I come to the band as well, of just kind of just do it. Because if it takes too long with planning or theory or practice, like practicing to be ready for it, it's just not going to happen. Like, learn in the moment and do. And I think the workshops as well, they always, each one is, it's a full workshop in itself, but it's always preparation for the next one. It's always research and development for where it's going to go. It's fun to do things for yourself, isn't it? So I had a lot of art lessons when I was younger, and lots of drawing lessons and things like that. And I always feel like, God, I wish I hadn't had so many lessons in that. I wish I'd spent longer just working out how I make images and make marks, and just found something more of that for myself. Because I think with drumming, I've had a few lessons, but I always feel like, no, I want to make this up. I want this to feel more specific, and I want it to feel more instinctive. So I think there's definitely been a choice. Yeah, a choice to keep things that way, to keep them away from a standardized way of doing it. And I feel like going into teaching shortly, as I will be, I want that to stay responsive, because I think in terms of decolonizing academia, I think that DIY attitude is a good thing to carry on, because otherwise, you know, you don't know what structures you're perpetuating. You need to learn about structures to a degree to know that you're not perpetuating it, but ideally try and stay out of taking those systems on to the point where they become unconscious and you can't help but replicate what you've been given, which I think very much happens for me in my drawing. And I'm like, God, it looks like that again, you know? And then you have to do something to like disrupt it and kind of break it apart to work out like, how can I reform this? Which is a fun thing to do, but it's very difficult.
And also very tiring.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was talking to my therapist about this and she was like, Georgia, you seem to struggle a lot. And I was like, do you know what, Karu? I think that's just what I like. I think it's just what I need. I think if it's not constantly, it's that karaoke thing, if it's not constantly on the edge of almost not working, then it feels a bit like, my interest drops off to a degree. I think that's just part of who I am as a person.
But it's interesting as well, because I'm a big believer, and this has been like part of my journey, is that actually the creativity and the new skills and the new ways of thinking are on the edge of the comfort zone. Are on those bits where you're like, fuck, I'm feeling really uncomfortable right now. Mm. And I think that's really interesting. It sounds like you're constantly pushing yourself to the edge. I'm like hovering and then I'll do a toe in and then I'll step back. But, you know, that's why like highly creative beings such as yourself, like I can see why you then were talking about early on about being tired, because you're constantly pushing your thinking, the way you are situated in any given space, system, and your own creative skill, like how can I push that, how can I challenge it?
Yeah, I am a bit addicted with the discomfort zone. Like, I'm quite obsessed with that, and in the podcast and in the workshops there's a whole moment of encouraging people to find a point within themselves that is the discomfort, and to learn what that feels like. There's so much change needs to happen in the world. If we don't get comfortable with that, we're going nowhere incredibly fast. And I think the comfort and the seeking of it, we obviously would need it. We have to have breaks, because otherwise you end up exhausted like I am, because you just can't stop looking at it. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, but you know, yeah, you're right. It is very tiring.
Because your brain doesn't switch off even when you're sleeping. You know, you're constantly trying to find solutions.
And I think that is a bit of the neurodiversity that I resonate with. It's almost like a necessary stimulation. Otherwise I'm falling asleep. It's kind of like these peaks and troughs, very hard to stay in that middle zone, you know, having to look for the next thing that's going to like take you up there, help you focus back in with that level of stimulation. I mean, definitely my work reflects that as well. Like, I'm always most comfortable when there's an alarm going off and somebody needs talking down from like throwing something across the room or what have you. It's useful to know about oneself. Thank you for helping me reflect on that, Renee.
I love like these conversations, because I, you know, as I was saying, like I reflect on my own kind of experiences and my own, I don't know, nuances, let's put it kindly. So yeah, thank you. As a creative maker, what skills would you say are needed to develop and continue, let's say, a practice of creativity?
Well, this is very interesting, and it's something I've been thinking about as a primary concern for about a year specifically, I would say. I think it's deeply individual, but there are some things that are more expansive, more generalizable. This is all very vague statements. A lot of people struggle with believing they're allowed to, that there's worth or value in the thing they're going to make or put out there. And I think that what's really important is the Kurt Vonnegut story of a class of children were asked to write to different writers and makers and ask for some advice about creativity. And he was the only one who wrote back. And he said, just write a story, write yourself a short story. And then, I can't remember if he said just throw it away or if it was to burn it. just don't show it to anybody, just throw it away. Because the point of that story will have been for you to find out who you're becoming. And I think that's such an important thing that we don't get told enough in schools, which is that your creative voice is actually primarily, it's a language to talk to yourself with. It's to find out who you are, who you become, what it looks like when you do. And in occupational therapy, we have the phrase, the sort of the key motto, which is doing, being, becoming. The band was for me in the beginning and continues to be, which was, well, that's what I want to do. So I'm going to do it. So then I will be it. So then I will be becoming myself. And that in itself is an upward spiral. Just returning to that, I think, is important. And finding that space of absolute play without sort of stakes or consequence. And then maybe sharing it if you want to. I made some ugly, big, ugly painting and showed it to a friend. And I was like, oh, I'm glad I made it. And I'm glad I showed it to them because it kicked something off. But I am going to tear that up. and yeah, like finding somebody to work with, I think can be hugely important. You know, you have accountability to each other. If you have similar concerns, it can be a real place for that to grow and feel like a fertile place. And it can either be with purpose and more of like real stakes, because I think with the band we would book gigs. Our gigs, we've got to practice, we've got to write songs because we're going to be on the thing, which I think is really useful. Yeah, so that sort of finding that balance between those places and spending some time reflecting on who you are as an individual, what you keep returning to, and you know, keep looking back for that thing that continues as like the thread that grows through it, to kind of take energy from that. And to reconnect and ground yourself, because I find it easy to get kind of scattered and not kind of know exactly why I'm here or there. But then I can return to that sort of doing, being, becoming, and like my hope for social justice. Like those are the two things that I can keep returning to as consistent if I'm not sure what I want to do in the piece of work that I'm making or in the music that I'm making. And joy, I think, is important. Like, what feeling are you getting? Are you getting a feeling that you want to keep feeling? Are you growing in a way you feel good about? And just check in with that regularly. And if not, do the thing, just smash it apart, you know?
Yeah, I love that. Having a multifaceted practice, because that's what, you know, you've got, I've got most creative people I know, because, you know, some pays more, other gives you more freedom, other stimulates you creatively. So kind of what advice would you give to someone considering going down a kind of creative multifaceted route?
The thing that I would have liked to have had is more peers around me on a similar path. Yeah, I think I would have really liked to have more peers who didn't refer to their non-art job as a money job, who were like, no, I'm passionate about this as well. And then to also have people who don't refer to their art practice and the creative things that they're doing as a hobby. So, but I don't know who those people are. I don't know where they are, particularly working in something that's explicitly not directly related to arts. If you're out there, would love to hear from you, would absolutely love it. I think just regularly reviewing the balance and also trying to keep your eye on a plan. So it's been my plan to have a part-time sort of professional job for a long time. After 2 years of study and 4 years of working, it's finally there. So I would just keep tuning into that plan finally. And then I think just doing small things if you can, so that you're keeping that sense of flow, reminding yourself that you are a creative person and you feel a lot better if you're able to do that. And I think also, yeah, wherever you can find people around you and your collaborations to help give you momentum, remind you that what you're doing is so valuable, even though it has value just for you. And then if other people enjoy it, then you have that value as well. But just whatever can kind of give you that, those little bits of outside help to keep you rolling forward. It's just a real push and pull. And for me, I think the thing that's kept me going, thinking, always recentering on what's helping, where do I feel like I'm flourishing? Where do I feel like there's potential to flourish? And make sure I'm gardening those areas, like I'm watering those areas as I go. I wish I had more coherent and succinct advice.
And I loved you got a little gardening analogy in there.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah.
We must garden ourselves.
Can you tell me what's been one of the biggest challenges you've faced in your career?
I mean, it's got to be the NHS. She will chew you up and spit you out. Yeah, that's, I think, surviving that. I think it's particularly at this time, and I think particularly for the cohort that, like, in the last 5 years, from what I can tell, it's been, I mean, it ramps up every year. Yeah, making it through. There's been some serious burnout. There's been just working in mental health as well. I love the job, and it's definitely, you know, it's the right job for me. And I like, you know, like I said, I like to be on the edge of capacity. in the place of discomfort and growth and struggle. But it took me a steep learning curve to learn that the NHS, the way it's run, will take everything and more and leave you as a husk if you don't put in some boundaries with your workplace. Also, people are becoming so unwell because of social factors, making things a lot worse. It's been hard to carry, not that I'm carrying it, but it's been hard to, like, you know, contain and hold. You take a lot on and then you need somewhere to put it. But at the same time, you know, the most transformative moments for me have also come through working with people. So learning so much about myself and being formed as much as supporting others, you know, sort of doing, being and becoming myself through being with others, both like in creative capacity, in the band, in personal practice, and in work. So it's sort of, the NHS puts it in a balance where it's taking more than it's giving. But, you know, that's not to say that the work itself is the problem. It's just the way that it's organized. So I think, yeah. But I think that it's really helped me with my boundaries and with some structure and with knowing where my limits are.
So before you go, I'm going to ask you a few more questions. How do you feel your creativity? And also, what's coming up for you? I know we are potentially heading into second lockdown, which is more than likely. So who knows? You said you are going to teach, which is super exciting. So any other gossip, band news?
How do I feel creativity? Just getting back to that now. Try and have some flipping fun. I've been listening to a lot of happy hardcore. I want to write some like happy hardcore music, but gayer. I want to, you know, just, I started playing the bass guitar after a while and found that incredibly enjoyable. And doing these jams with my friend, that's all helping me start to feel like I'm refertilizing the ground. Going into teaching is very exciting because there's lots of time to, like, you know, read on things, and bringing in texts that wouldn't normally be included in healthcare teaching is giving me a lot of energy at the moment and feeling more inspired. So really wanting to use Uses of the Erotic by Audre Lorde as a teaching text in occupational therapy education, because to me, I mean, that's all about pleasure and joy being confined to sex and then sex being made obscene. So it all has to be kept there. Flow, connection, presence in emotional experience has sort of been tucked away. How do we destigmatize that, make it not obscene, and bring this feeling of erotic, of enjoyment, of experience of sensuality and flow and enjoyment of creative self out into the world? So thinking about how to radicalize healthcare education is something I'm enjoying. And in terms of things coming up, we were going to have a tour, but obviously that is the least advisable thing. So we have three tracks that we've recorded, and we have another one that it would be nice to record. So we're going to get those tracks mastered, and then we're going to think about interesting ways to release them. You know, is there anything else that we want to do? Yeah, just trying to think a bit more expansively about that. And I think for myself, I'm just going to think more about writing, and I'd like to think about developing the workshop in a different way, restructure it, and then where would be the right place to offer something like that. Just thinking about, who am I? Why am I offering it? What does it mean for me to offer it? Who am I offering it to? And what support can I legitimately offer?
A lot of thinking time, Georgia.
A big lot of thinking time, yeah.
So something I ask everyone before we end the session is there a career or job in the creative industries you know little about? Because then I can seek out someone in that role and potentially, you know, break open what that is so other people can consider that as part of their maybe career path. And then the other thing is a woman or a person who's non-binary that you would recommend for the podcast.
So in terms of, oh my gosh, what was the first one again? Careers that I don't know much about. I don't know much about music production. For me, it goes in a bracket with curation and publishing. I don't really know what they are. Very broad. And in terms of like women and non-binary people, just like loads.
You can say more than one. That's fine.
Okay.
So maybe three if you've got like a load.
Well, there's my bandmates, of course. Mm-hmm. But can they count as one?
I love that you're pushing the limits already.
So there's Tanya O'Claire, who is making this amazing music and has been making amazing music and videos all through this lockdown about her beekeeping. Mm-hmm. And Ruby Green is great. They're a musician and artist. And yeah, I really beautiful, haunting music. And I'd be really interested to see what they had to say in this interview.
Okay, cool. So that's three-ish people. Cool. Georgia, I've so loved catching up with you. This discussion has given me so much to think about in terms of my own creative practice, but also to think about how I can get more involved and prepare myself for the brighter future that's maybe a little bit down the line.
It's just it's just around a corner at the moment.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks so much. That's been really great. Really enjoyed it. She has a nice way. But when she gets her way, he'll be sorry.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed, please write a review and rate, as that helps other people find Greater Than 11%. Also, stay subscribed to keep up to date on the weekly releases.